Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. Thanks for joining us. And we are here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. Today we're going to talk about, birthday cake, apples, and jam and jelly. Yes. This weekend, speaking of birthday cake, was the KHOI birthday bash. This very radio station has been around in this community for 11 years. It is something to celebrate. And people gathered, and there was music, and we had a good time in the streets. It was just fine. And also, earlier this month, I put in another milestone myself, and Donna was nice enough to bake me a birthday cake, and it was lovely. The cake was lovely. But Donna, tell a little bit about the cake, and especially the frosting.
Oh, we have a frosting trick. This is kind of our new. I am not a fan of, high sugar, fluffy frostings of any sort, chocolate, vanilla, anything like that, or the kind that you get if you buy the birthday cake at the grocery store, for example. So we have this new solution that is so easy. I really love it. It's very spreadable. It's in a double boiler, which for me is a bowl over a pot, a metal bowl placed over a pot of boiling water with the water not touching the bottom of the bowl, okay? So just enough to melt the chocolate. So you take chocolate chips, depending on the size of cake. Let's say 1 cup of chocolate chips. Now, I like dark chocolate, and Lana likes dark chocolate. So for Lana's cake, we use dark chocolate chips. But you can use milk chocolate chips. Don't use white chocolate chips, okay? But either milk chocolate chips or dark chocolate chips. So you just melt them in the double boiler till they're kind of a chocolatey mass, and no distinct chips in it. And then you take it off the double boiler and you, using a whisk, you beat in sort of the same amount, like if you used a cup of chocolate chips, more or less a cup of sour cream. The only trick is the sour cream must be at room temperature, because if it's too cold, it will just seize the chocolate chips back up again. So it's really simple. You just are mixing the melted chocolate chips with the room temperature sour cream, and there's nothing else you have to do. So you just mix that up, and then it's nice and thick, and you want lots of it. So I had already made the cake, and as we've been doing this one that we kind of like amongst our friends, which is the adult birthday cake, which is made with olive oil and has some wine in it. So, but any yellow cake will do. And ours, we usually put some jam or jelly in the middle. And since I was in the middle of making plum jam, I put plum rose geranium jam between the two layers. And then using an offset spatula, which is not an expensive tool, but a really lovely one for spreading things around, you spread it on fairly thick, and I made it go down over the sides, but kind of like it were just dribbling off a little bit, not all the way down to the bottom. It's really spreadable. And then you can set it in the refrigerator, to let it even firm up a little bit more. It's so easy and so good.
Thanks for the birthday cake, Donna.
You are so welcome. I'm glad you had a happy birthday.
I did. And as we're sitting around the table there, talking about birthday cakes and the fall and things, well, fall is here and the trees are starting to turn and fruit is falling, and our thoughts turned to apples. And we all put in our little 2 cents about what we knew about apples, and at around the table, and actually joining us here today, is someone that has something to say about apples and most anything else, if you ask him. His name is Barry McDonald.
Yes, Barry is our friend from Australia, and he's been regaling us with many tales for the last year about what goes on in Australia. And I was teasing him that he's here on a walkabout from Australia. So Barry told me what walkabout means in Australia, which is not what I thought it meant at all. So do tell us, Barry.
Thank you, Donna. And thanks, Lana. I'm very happy to be here. I'm very privileged to be in your studio, but also loving being in Ames. It's a great place to hang out. And I feel more at home here in Ames than I do at home in Australia.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
What's that say about Australia, Barry?
Yeah, walkabout. Okay, so a few people have used that term to me in America. we don't tend to use it in Australia because it really has racist origins. It's an English term to describe
English as in English language. Yeah,
to describe a phenomenon, arising in the 19th century when Australia was colonised, invaded and colonised by white-skinned peoples who took over land. And if Aboriginal people were lucky, they weren't either killed or expelled from their traditional lands, but they were sort of embraced or enveloped by grazing properties that had been marked out by Europeans, right? So Aboriginal people could sometimes live on the properties in return for working for nothing.
Indentured servants, short of slaves, but not quite.
Indentures. Yeah. Maybe in return for rations, but basically, they were living there and they were living a traditional lifestyle, more or less. They were living together in community. At certain times of the year, they would decamp to travel for ceremonial purposes. The Europeans never knew what was going on, and when at certain crucial times in the summer months, mainly when Aboriginal people were needed for work processes,
cattle and stuff like
whatever it might be, sheep. Yeah, mm-hmm. Suddenly they weren't around to help, and the Europeans, in exasperation, would say, "Where have they gone? They've gone walkabout again," not understanding the ceremonial
requirements. There was a cultural, spiritual significance for the Aboriginals.
Yeah, so in a way, walkabout, to say that an Aboriginal person's gone walkabout is a sort of put down, that suggests Aboriginal people aren't trustworthy. They won't be there when you need them, all that sort of stuff. Yeah, so I tend not to use the term.
Yes. Well, okay. So in my American obliviousness, I had a whole romantic thought that it meant sort of following the song lines and seeking your spiritual purpose. All right, so how's this, Barry? I'll call you an itinerant musician. Okay. Is that any better?
That'll do.
He does play music. So anyway, Barry has come.
And following my soul's dictates.
Yes, exactly.
And I'm here in America for that reason.
Okay, all right. Okay, so got that cleared up. But why we had one ad Barry on the show is he and I've been exchanging kind of things our mothers used to say, basically. And I know I've said this on the radio before. We were talking about my mom used to say, "Oh, he's got a frog in every pocket," which means it's somebody who's like full of new ideas and all kinds of things are happening and, that kind of thing. Well, Barry had another frog one. What was it your mother used to say?
She used to say, "He's gone off like a frog in a sock."
He's gone off like a frog in a sock. Okay.
Like maybe a child would throw a tantrum, right?
A frog in a sock. Okay. All right. And then you had another frog one. What was that?
Well, that was about I invited a couple of old guys that I knew to lunch at my house one time a few years ago. And they came from a very remote sort of rural area nearby where I lived. Their community had a very strong culture, Anyway, so I made them lunch and I asked them if they wanted a cup of tea. "Yes, we'd like a cup of tea. How do you have it? Just plain black, thank you." But could you put a bit of frog's milk in it? And I scratched my head. I said, I'd love to, if only I had some, you know, what frog's milk? And it turns out it's just an inch of cold water on the top of the...
To dilute it.
To cool it down.
Frog's milk is an inch of cold water. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Write that down. That's an important thing.
Frog's milk. Okay. Need to know, right? Okay.
Right.
So, this being our apple show, we did get around to some apple things. And they do apples in Australia...
Sure do.
Much like we do here, except the opposite times of year because it's down under, as we would say.
Yep.
So, I think Barry told us pippins were originated. Was it pippins?
No, Granny Smith's.
Granny Smith's came from Australia.
Yes, tell us about the Granny Smith apple. My goodness.
Righto. So the Granny Smith apple, do you know the Granny Smith apple? It's that green one.
The one that is absolutely the best for pies and cooking.
Yep. Okay, so its reputation, its advantages, I've just looked this up.
Oh, good.
I did a little bit of research before I came down here. But I sort of know this anyway. It's a great cooking apple.
Yes.
It's the best.
And they're always green.
They're always green. Though if they get too ripe, they go yellow.
Oh, do
apparently.
They?
Yeah.
Oh, but you don't want to buy the yellow ones because they'll get mushy.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well, don't know, because they keep extraordinarily well. Apparently, they're the best keeping apple around. They can keep in the right conditions for a year. No worries.
They're quite crisp.
Yeah. So, that's the Granny Smith. Now, the Granny Smith, its origins, there was a woman named Granny Smith, right? So, she migrated to Australia from England in the 1830s, maybe, or, I think so. Now, just outside Sydney, which is the capital city of New South Wales, there was an orchard area by the name of Eastwood or Ride Epping. There are three names around, you know, for the same area basically, that are now suburbs of Sydney. But at that time, they were rural and they were orchard fruit growing areas. Now, Granny Smith had an orchard with her husband. She was experimenting apparently with some crab apples, French crab apples, and their value for cooking, and she was chucking stuff out her window, right, and a spore seedling sprang up that had been cross-pollinated somehow somewhere along the line, which became the Granny Smith apple. So
it just grew outside of her window
by accident, outside the window. allowed it to grow or transplant it, put it somewhere. It produced the apples. She thought they were fabulous, and it grew from there. That was 1868. Okay. Right. So, I mean, that's pretty much the story. And the Granny Smith apple accounted for an enormous percentage of Australia's food exports during the 20th century. And apparently it's considered the third most popular apple variety in the United States.
Yes, it is. I think so. In cookbooks, it's the one most frequently referred to for, you know, good baking, good cooking. My assumption was that it was an English variety simply because so many good varieties have come to us from England through colonization.
Well, actually, that's maybe how it happened, because she had a tree, maybe she brought a tree, and she was propagating the seeds outside her kitchen window. Who knows? But anyway, something worked out well. I also looked up the reason it preserves so well. It has an unusually low level of ethylene. Ethylene is that gas that ripens things. And so it sits there quite nicely for quite a while. And,
yeah, it does an off gas. Apples do.
We have a news flash here. Mike Metz, who has another show on this fine radio station, just called in to our show. Somebody's listening, Doug.
Oh,
don't fall
goodness.
Out of your chair.
Okay.
Mike Metz, he has another frog thing he would like
to add
to this. He says
we're on a roll here.
He is familiar with the phrase, so close you can't get a frog hair in there.
See? So a frog hair. Okay. Frog's milk, frog's hair. Okay.
Thank you, Mike.
Frogs are very lively. Say it again, what your mother used to say. He's gone off
like a frog in a sock.
Like a frog in a sock.
Okay. Also, back to the Granny Smith apple, there are some cultural references besides being from Australia, which also Barry is from Australia, but the Granny Smith apple was one of four apples honored by the United States Postal Service in 2013 with memorial stamps of historic strains of apple joining the Northern Spy Baldwin and Golden Delicious. And so the Granny Smith was on our stamps there for a while. I like buying pretty stamps. I probably bought some of those. And, okay, in 1968, put on your memory hat here. The band The Beatles used an image of the Granny Smith as a logo for their company and for their record label at Apple Records. So, yes, it is official. The Granny Smith apple is a good one. There you go.
Yep. And it's been celebrated in poetry.
Yeah, very good.
Oh, yeah.
Do tell.
Okay. Barry's got one more very good Australian.
Well, I was talking about my mother. My mother taught me this limerick when I was a kid. I'm sure it was my mother. I don't know where it came from, but most stuff comes from my mother in my memory. There was an old lady from Ryde who ate some green apples and died. The apples fermented inside the lamented and made cider inside her inside.
Now, we often have cultural high points here on the show, and that was one of them. Thank you,
Barry. I want just one more repeat, because it rolls off of your tongue. So say it one more time.
Okay.
So we can remember it to say to our children, too.
Okay. There was an old lady from Ryde who ate some green apples and died. The apples fermented inside the lamented and made cider inside her inside.
Lovely. So we asked Barry to come on the radio show just to do that performance. It was really... This is our apple show, folks, so here we go.
It is.
More useful information. Thank you, Barry.
It's a pleasure, Donna.
Good.
Okay.
Yes. Before you go, Barry, I want to ask, there are things you can probably eat in Australia that you can't eat here. Does one eat kangaroo?
One eats kangaroo. You can buy kangaroo in all the major supermarkets.
Okay, so it's not just a go out and hunt one. You can actually buy one. You can eat it in the supermarket.
You can. Yeah, and the reason that you can do that is that there is a national cull, annual cull of kangaroos because, and this is something I actually researched and wrote a scholarly paper on once, that colonization actually benefited the populations of grey kangaroos, which are the main kangaroo species on the eastern side of the country. It benefited their expansion. So
took away their predators or something?
Well, no. It was creating more ideal habitat by the cutting down of trees, the clearing of forests, the creation of grasslands. And they're grazers. And they like to have forests close to, on the edge of grazing, of grasslands.
So that's
what was being done, the creation of these habitats. So explosion in kangaroo numbers. Nobody understood what was going on at the time, just that, you know, kangaroos were getting more and more plentiful. Anyway, so there is a national cull. Not everyone's in favour of it, only professional hunters that are licensed by the government can actually shoot kangaroos.
So is it sort of like our deer hunting season?
No.
No?
No, this is professional. This is not recreational.
Oh.
No, this is to reduce the number of kangaroos in the country because it's considered to be a...
nuisance, as they say.
Yeah, nuisance, whatever. So there are, say, maybe 5... to 7 million kangaroos culled a year by professional shooters, and the products are used for pet food, but also for human consumption.
So it actually goes into the national meat supply. I mean, can you imagine going to the Hy-Vee and you could buy kangaroo meat?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
It's like, well, they're kind of like the deer here. Yeah, I could imagine.
But you can't go to the supermarket and buy
deer. And it's like venison.
Does it taste like venison, kind of?
Yeah, I guess. Not that I've eaten a great deal of venison, I've eaten a lot of kangaroo.
There you go. They're grazers, you know, I suppose.
They are. And the meat is very lean. So apparently 10% fat is considered lean.
Yeah.
And kangaroo meat's 2%, contains 2% fat.
Even
so
less.
It's very lean. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. So how big are these kangaroos?
Big as me.
Right. Oh, my.
So they can stand 6 feet tall.
Goodness.
I don't know how heavy they are, but they're a formidable opponent. You don't want to cross a kangaroo that maybe doesn't want you to be where they are.
They're not as bad as bears, for example, are they?
No, they don't eat you. But no, they don't, but they can inflict injury, and kangaroos have been known to kill human beings. They will kill dogs,
But they're not carnivores. They're herbivores.
Yeah.
But they have big, mean back feet.
They have big, mean back feet that can slice your gizzards, innards. Anyway, but they're not aggressive animals, normally speaking. Yeah. So it's not as though we wander around living in fear of kangaroos. Not at all. And not a lot of people eat kangaroo meat. I mean, it's a specialty sort of food stuff. That probably very few people eat. I'd probably be in a great minority.
And do they use the hides also?
Yeah, absolutely. It's great leather. I've got two pairs of shoes.
Kangaroo shoes.
That are made of kangaroo leather. Yeah, I should have worn them. But it's for weight, strongest leather in the world, I think.
Huh.
It's very light.
Are those something to get those shoes? Are they handmade or they're in the market? No.
Handmade.
You don't go to the shoe store
and
get kangaroo leather.
No.
They don't make automobile seats out of kangaroo leather.
No.
Like they do.
No.
It's
a very specialized area.
Okay.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Do you have, before we move on to other things, Barry, do you have anything that you'd like to comment about your time spent here in Iowa? Something you've learned? Something you've noticed?
Are we something that surprised you?
That's a hard question. You should have asked me that. One of the things that surprises me is that, we seem to have very similar cultures, right? The Australian culture and the American culture. However, and I spoke to an American who lived in Australia for 6 months, and she confirmed that the two cultures are just out by about 5 degrees, which makes it really difficult because you think you might be saying what another person would understand is in the same way as you are, but you're not, because certain words, same words, have different meanings. So I'm learning all that, you know. Sometimes words have sort of opposite meanings, like the word moot. So the way you use the word moot is different to the way we use the word moot.
If you say
it's a moot point, it means it's done and dusted and, you know, it's just academic
really matter,
now. It's, no. Whereas the word for us means it's still being considered. It's alive. It's not been, it's not been decided yet. It's moot.
Well, enough to make us glad to meet new people and kind of stir up our brains.
Yeah, and here it is. The English language has lots of complications.
Well, yeah. So
that's great.
But my experience of Ames has been fabulous. Mainly the friendliness of Midwesterners. I was in a cafe having a cup of coffee, and I was around the corner from where the counter was, where the barista was pulling coffees for people, and I heard a guy talking loudly to the barista saying that he'd just come visiting from New York, and he was gobsmacked by the friendliness of the people that he had encountered here.
That's the Iowa Nice. There you go.
Iowa Nice. Yeah. There you go. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, we're glad you're here. Thanks for joining us today. We've been talking to Barry McDonald. We learned wonderful things about apples and language. There you go. This is KHOI, and this is the Donalana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. This is the Donalana Kitchen. Well, we talked about the Granny Smith apple in Australia and got some first-hand information and some good things we can use about apples and frogs and things. Now we're going to go into something else about the fall. It seems that this has been a fruit year to end all fruit years, Donna. The trees are just dropping fruit all over the place.
Yeah, it's we're giving it away like overgrown zucchinis this time. You've opened your back door and somebody's left Concord grapes for you.
For instance, yes. And there's been plums, and there's been peaches, and there's been, well, actually, and raspberries, and there's been all kinds of stuff. So, what do you do this time of year when you get piles
of
things?
Oh, man, we are just, you know... Well, first of all, I just wanted all to know that Lana is the consummate jam and jelly maker. And we'll just put right here the distinction between jams and jellies. You know, jellies are clear with no fruit body in it. And jam has the jammy bits, has the bits of the fruit.
The lumps, yeah.
The fruit
in it. Yeah,
the
fruit lumps,
so
yes.
To make jellies, you cook the fruit down and then you put it in some sort of jelly bag.
A mesh something or other.
Something that you hang up over a pan and then just the... And you don't squeeze it. Because if you squeeze it, you'll get some of the... Too much of the fruit body coming through it. And you just let it hang. And then the juices that drip through make your clear jellies. So, like Lana has a... Describe your fruit jam, your jelly bag.
Oh, well, you can buy jelly. You can just use a piece of muslin or a piece of cloth, but you can find jelly bags where you buy things like jelly jars and pectin. In sometimes in grocery stores and sometimes in hardware stores that sell that sort of thing, along with your canning funnels and the tongs and everything that you just might find handy. My jelly bag is kind of preformed. It's like a big pouch.
Yeah, it's a bag already.
It's a big bag with a little bit of elastic on the top that fits nicely over the pan that I am pouring into. As I do this year after year, I do make a mess, but I'm making less of a mess.
So, but you still tie it shut and hang it up, right?
Still tie it shut. I pour, well, it's probably pretty hot. I put hot, cooked, like I just did some pears recently, cooked down pears until they were mushy, poured them into this jelly bag that was already sitting in a big soup pot, and then gathered the bag tied it off with a piece of string, leaving a whole lot of extra string on the ends. Then I move that whole soup pot with the jelly bag in it. I do this on the floor on a pot holder because it's still warm. And then suspend the bag on a broom handle in between two chairs so the bag is up above the pan and it drips. It can drip overnight. Now, this is real high-tech, folks.
Yeah,
this
and it takes a while. Now, my jelly bag is, I brought this back from me with in France, and this is a traditional thing. It's it looks like a sort of overly large tea towel, and it's made out of linen, so it's kind of a large rectangle, but it's enough to then, you know, you pour the same sort of things. You put it in the pan, you pour the boiled fruit because you want the and do you put the pectin in before?
No, not then. You don't want to.
Okay, you just boil the fruit down with some water, not too much, and same thing. Tie it, bring all the ends together, tie it with a string, and hang it.
Yes. Yes. And you can drip it overnight if you want to.
Because you want to extract as much as, mm-hmm. and don't squeeze it.
Don't squeeze it.
Yeah, it's tempting, but don't squeeze it.
And then when you're done, use the stuff that's gone into the pan on the bottom and the stuff in the jelly bag. Well, I don't know what you do with yours, but mine goes to the chickens.
The chickens
they eat all that kind of stuff. And you can do that with any fruit. Extract the jam, the liquid from it, that's good.
Like with Lana's pears, there's a very good reason for making jelly out of them, because the pears that she's got, and this is not true of all pears, but some varieties have a lovely flavor, but they have a sort of grit in their texture. And I made this mistake one year. Somebody gave me a whole bunch of local pears, and I thought, oh, goody, goody, I'm going to make pear butter, right? So I went through all of this work and ended up with stuff that tasted like it had, the flavor was great, but the texture was like it had sandpaper in it.
Yeah, that happens to some pear varieties. And I don't know if it has to do with the growing conditions or not, but
and I think it's a varietal.
It's a varietal thing. But anyway, I did end up with pear, just plain old pear juice to drink is fine. But out of those pears, I do, like you said, I do like making jams and jellies, and I do like mixing my flavors. To heck with just plain pear jelly.
Well, yeah, if you're going to make your own, and this is a wonderful luxury, don't make a flavor that you can just buy at the grocery store. Personalize it a little bit. Customize it. So what did you put in your pear?
Well, see, I had a wild plum tree that did just dandy this year. A wild plum tree. Iowa wild plums, they're small. They're golden. They turn to a blushy red on the inside and outside.
And they're tart, right?
And they're very tart, which was a nice addition to the rather, I don't want to say boring, but just kind of pear-ish pear. Those two things together were very good.
Okay, now, does that mean you boiled them in the pot together and then hung them in the jelly bag?
Because they came ripe separately. So what you can do what you can do is take this juice and put it in an old milk jug or something plasticky, a milk container, and put it in the freezer. Don't put it all the way filled up to the top. Fill it like 3/4 full. Label it, and say wild plum juice on it. Then I could go in my freezer and pull it out. Because the wild plums were ripe about 2 weeks ago. And the pears are just coming now. So it's a really nice song and dance you can do with your fruit trees this time of year, because things come at different times.
Right. You can mix your fruit. The other thing you can do, for example, the pear might be really interesting if you threw a store anise in to boil the fruit.
Yes. Yeah. See, a pear will have, I don't want to say it's like a zucchini, but it's kind of a open taste. You can add more stuff.
It does not have a strong flavor. It has a lovely flavor.
So I have done that too. I haven't done star anise, but I've used other like Christmassy cinnamon and cloves and Christmassy mm-hmm. flavor, and then just call that your Christmas pear extravaganza or something. And then you get to label these things and give them away as gifts. And, oh, it's good.
Well, and that's why when I had all these beautiful damps and plums, that's why I put rose geranium in mine, because, of course, I love rose geranium, and I find it's particularly good. It's also good in strawberries, but any slightly tart fruit, although it wouldn't be bad in a pear.
Yeah.
The other thing I've been putting, which would be nice in pear, would be the lemon verbena leaves.
Ah.
So, and both the lemon verbena and the rose geranium will have to be coming in from the garden soon and will have to be cut back. So I will be having plenty of those herbs to use. Oh, you could do mint. Mint apple jelly.
Yes, very good.
All kinds of things like that. And I also want to mention, besides jams and jellies and butters, now, okay, apple butter, mm-hmm. all that is you're taking your jam and you're cooking it down and reducing it and reducing it until it becomes thick. And with my apple butters and pear butters, if you don't have the gritty pears, are also good. Or pumpkin butter. Mm-hmm. Well, with pumpkin butter, you might have to put sugar in. But with apple and pear butter, you just cook them down and no sugar needed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have used, people talk about, for the butters, you make it into the jam stage and then put it on a cookie sheet in a low oven and let it reduce like that. Or I've used crock pots to cook them down.
Crock pots are good,
Because it's very easy to burn them on the bottom if you're using the stovetop method.
Oh, yes.
And then you've ruined the whole damn thing.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Very so we good. Don't want to do that. There are other things you can do. Bottled fruits, like, it's kind of like canning, but like I did peaches when we had a lot of peaches. I just cooked peaches in syrup with, I think I put lemon verbena, and I popped them in the freezer and said to myself, this is for Christmas. You can make, vinegars are coming up. Fruit vinegars would be good. Fruit liqueurs would be good. Sauces. Okay, I made a plum, it's kind of Chinese-y. Like, well, if you go to the Chinese restaurant, they'll have a sweet and sour sauce, or sometimes it's called a plum sauce. I followed a recipe. I've done this 2 years in a row. It's in a Hugh Fernley Whittingstall River Cottage cookbook. So you've got your plum jam made already, and then you take that, and to that you add, I'll just say, some tamari or soy sauce, some garlic, and some Chinese rice wine vinegar to taste, right?
Mm.
And, of course, it needs to be sweet.
Mm.
Pretty sweet. And then when I was cooking that down to, like, cook the garlic and incorporate the flavors, I actually put in some Thai basil.
Huh.
And then I just put it in some glass jars. And because of the vinegar and salt content, it will keep in the refrigerator. Last year, I had it in the refrigerator for, it was maybe 6 months or at least 4 months before I used it all up.
Mm-hmm.
It does keep pretty well, and it's really good on fried rice.
Yes.
Yes.
So jams and jellies that are sweet and savory, it's all good. It's all good.
Lana, do you want to tell us about your special jam pan?
Oh, I'll mention this. I purchased a pan called a Maslin pan. And I love my Maslin pan. Do not try to rip it out of my cold, dead fingers, because it is nice. It's large.
It's beautiful.
It has a flared top made for getting rid of extra steam, and it has a very, very heavy bottom. It is made for jams and jellies.
And it has a good handle on it, and doesn't it?
It's like a spout.
Stainless steel. It's almost like a classic milk pail with a slightly different shape.
Right.
And, of course, the heavy bottom.
Yes. That has been, I have learned to like jams and jellies because of that. You don't have to stand there for, of course, you have to stir occasionally. But It is a real lifesaver for being able to dawdle around the kitchen, do lots of things at once, which I tend to do, and have some jam on the stove.
What's it called again?
Maslin.
Spell that.
M-A-S-L-I-N. It is a French pan cookware. You can find, they are rather pricey. You can find them at a better, cooking stores. Traditionally, they are made out of copper. Mine is not copper. I did not want to dish out.
Way too fussy.
But anyway, the Maslin pan, if you like fussing around with sweet stuff, I suggest doing that. I want to mention, too, that this is another place to find more sweet things. This is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more at www.khoifm.org, and you can find our webpage there. More about us, there's our archives and recipes. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're just so excited about all kinds of good stuff because there's fruit and good things to put in little jars this time of year. What do you have, Donna?
Well, I was going to give you a little quote from this fairly new book called Pulp, P-U-L-P, by Abra Behrens. It's called, the subtitle's A Practical Guide to Cooking with Fruit. 215 sweet and savory recipes with variations, including a baker's toolkit. Okay, she is a Michigan cookbook author, so that is a large fruit-growing region, as Iowa once was, and we're trying to get more of that back, but she has this nice thing to say about apples. She says, apples are a great illustration of the difference between farm scale and market. There are 7,500 apple varieties in the world, and yet the average grocery store usually has about 6 varieties on hand year-round. Ironically, this always looks like a diverse array compared to the one type of banana, one type of peach, two types of melon, one type of strawberry, one type of blueberry, and so on. I have learned that the reason for this, it is an issue of scale standardization and market outlet. Farms exist in all sizes, from the micro farm that grows on postage stamp sized plots of land in all environments, urban, suburban, and rural gardens, to the mega farms cultivating thousands of acres. So in order to achieve economies of scale, a farmer can't grow 10 acres of 20 different crops. They need to stick to a handful of one variety to be efficient. Once they are growing 200 acres of apples, well, quite frankly, that's a lot of apples and too many to hand sell at the farmer's market. So what she talks about is the fruit markets are, one, the retail, which is grower to consumer, farmer's markets, which we have quite a few around the state. Number two is the larger grower to retail market supported by large scale distributors, which is like what you buy at the Hy-Vee. And the third one is the commodity grower to processor preserved fruit market. That's where they like sell it for applesauce. So these are vastly different scales. So fortunately here in Iowa, we have at this time of the year a lot of access to really, really good apples. I'm going to mention just four places that are people that we've had on the radio station mostly. There's, of course, Wilson's Orchard on the east side of the state, which also grows other fruit, has a destination like food, all kinds of restaurant, and they make wonderful ciders. There's Berry Patch right here in the middle of Iowa over by Nevada, and they do apples and other you-pick kinds of things. So if you want to take your kid out to climb and pick his own apple tree, pick from the apple tree, it's lots of fun.
You don't want kids to climb apple trees.
You don't?
You break the apple trees.
Oh, dear. That's a bad thing.
Well, yeah.
Well, you could just stand underneath and reach
yes,
up,
you
right?
Could. Okay. Yes, you could.
Okay. All right. Then there's the Wills Family Farm, which is an idyll, which has apples and I do believe pumpkins, yeah, too, for picking your own. And then there's Deals, which they do sell at the Ames Farmers Market. And even I think Fairway Markets have Deals apples. And they also make both hard cider and soft cider.
Good stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And the difference, of course, is the soft cider is basically the fresh pressed apple juice. And then both Wilson's and Deals does a fermented, you know, alcoholic version. Lovely, lovely stuff. So we've got plenty of apples here this time of year. Lucky us.
Yes. Well, another thought about jams and jellies. Thickening up all this
wonderful
stuff. Oh,
the mysteries of pectin. I never get this right, but Lana is such an old hand at it. I just call her when I get stuck.
Old hand is right. I have spent years having things turn out hard as rock or not gelling at all. Guess what, people? Every fruit is different. Some fruit has pectin already in it, although you
can... Now, pectin is in apple seeds? Is that
the
common source of
it? Green apples. Green apples have lots of pectin, and other things have... apricots have some, and plums have some, but the commercial pectin that you get used to be made from green apples, actually made from the must, the leftovers of cooking things down, or pressing apples for cider. They'd take the apples and get the pectin out that way. But now it's mainly made from citrus peels because that is evidently intensely full of pectin. Sources of pectin include, apples have 1 to 2%, that's fine. But citrus peels have as much as 30%. Of pectin, and rose hips, believe it or not, are really high in pectin. But thank goodness somebody does the pectin for us. That's fine because I don't want to be cooking down. You can cook down green apples and make your own kind of little green apple jelly that would be your pectin. But it's much nicer to have something that is already measured out for you. And I've gone through, there's a lot of different things on the market. You buy those little boxes of pectin, and they've got a nice little recipe page on the inside for cooked jelly, for freezer jam jelly, and cooked jam, and you can just follow the recipes. Basically, it is measure everything, bring your jelly juice or your jam to a boil to which you have added the appropriate amount of pectin, and each
so you put the pectin in when the juice is cold.
When the juice is cold, because it clumps up a little bit if you put it in hot.
So what do you do to dissolve it? Do you have to whisk it in or something?
It's like Jello.
It will dissolve.
It dissolves pretty well. Then, important part, bring that mixture to a boil. Don't put in sweetening yet. Bring that mixture to a boil. Make sure it is a full boil. That's the important part.
So it's like using cornstarch in that way.
Yeah, you have to bring it to a full boil. Then add the pre-measured sugar, which you can follow from the recipe, depending on the fruit. And then you add that. And, again, bring that to a full boil.
Okay, now I have a question. In the pectin guides, where it says how much pectin to use, does it give it by the fruit, like strawberry needs this much, plum needs this much? Because it's different by the fruit, right?
Yes, it is very different, very different. And often you'll also see suggestions of adding lemon. I usually add lemon to just about everything because a little bit of acid helps the pectin set. And it doesn't do the taste bad either, but adding a little lemon juice at that stage too. But the idea of these two boils really makes sense.
Okay, I'm a little skeptical about one thing. If your recipe suggestions tell you how much sugar to use, that doesn't sit right with me because, A, I don't like my jellies as sweet as the conventional stuff. Here's something I think is true about jams and jellies. If you were buying the grocery store jelly that everybody is used to, you get this very idea of super, super, super sweet, right? Here's the reason. Sugar, when you're manufacturing like grape jelly or something, sugar is way less expensive than the fruit. So they put a lot of sugar in for the amount of fruit. Now, if you're making your own jams and jellies, and if you're bothering to do this, you can have the luxury of using less sugar and having more fruit flavor in it.
Yes, you can do that. I think the, especially the old little boxes of fruit pectin, always ask for way too much sugar. I just started backing off of that. Now you can find, even in the boxes, but even separately are sold, something called, from the Ball Corporation, real fruit, low or no sugar needed fruit pectin.
Uh-huh.
And you can really, really, whereas the old-fashioned suggestion was, believe it or not, like a cup of sugar to each cup of fruit.
Now, that just makes my teeth kind of grind together.
Back off. I'm down to the low-sugar thing, to a half a cup or even less of sugar to fruit. You can go, I haven't gone to the no sugar at all. I like sugar, but you can really, really back off. And yes, you taste the
fruit. Yeah, because I kind of like to make it to taste. You know,
I'll add some sugar,
taste it. Like the plums this year, the damsons that I was cooking with were actually, I had to add more sugar than I thought, but I kept going because once you put it in, you don't take it out, right?
Right.
So I kept adding till I hit the note that I wanted.
You can do that.
Now, do you use that? Is this the one where you put the plate in the freezer and you test the pectin? You don't do that?
Oh, no, I don't freeze it. There is a wise old woman trick called the spoon test, which is dip a metal spoon in your jam or jelly that's bubbling there. And if it is ready to set, it will coat the spoon nicely, turn the spoon on the side. And if it comes off in sheets, as opposed to just running off like water, if it comes off in a drip and it kind of hangs there, it's ready. Also, I also put a little dot on.
So that's when you know you've got enough pectin.
Yeah, and I also put a little dot on a saucer on the countertop, and it should set up when it's ready.
When it's set up means
thick enough, rather than a puddle. And then more jam and jelly tricks. The idea is to get into hot jars. Hot, clean, and quick. I think hot, hot, clean, clean, quick.
It's called hot packing.
Hot packing. The jars are hot. The lids are hot. And you do this dance in the kitchen and don't burn yourself. And you'll have a nice bunch of jam and jelly. Well, we talked about jam and jelly today, and we learned a lot about Australia, kangaroo meat, and apples.
Frogs. Yeah, we got a frog in every pocket here.
We do. Well, we have some upcoming things to talk about. I want to mention KHOI out in the lobby here. We've got two quilts that are part of an online KHOI auction.
Handmade quilts
by Bonnie Treaty. And with the thoughts of colder weather, think of quilts. Stop in and look at that, and then go to the KHOI website and make a bid on that, khoifm.org.
Yes, they are quite beautiful, artfully done, those quilts.
Wonderful. Good. And if you just can't get enough of the Donna Lana Kitchen, we do our best here to cover all sorts of topics. We have a podcast.
We do. If you are a podcast listener, wherever you listen to your podcast, just type in Donna Lana. That's one word, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, second word, kitchen, and there you will find us.
This is the Donna Lana Kitchen that you've been listening to. Thanks for joining us today. We had a good romp through the kitchen again. Lots of good things to share with you. We had music by the Barn Owl Band. You heard the musical priest. And we're going out with a tune called the Sunday River Waltz. A little waltzing. So don't be shy. Waltz around your kitchen. It's a good thing to do. Support this fine radio station. Fall into fall. Make something sweet. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
You've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.